Ciao.
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 That's not the right way to do three on fingers.
I just wonder what you were doing.
That's how Germans do it.
Got really confused.
Three glasses. It's 2016. We're all here. I've not been washed away by the floods, which is the most important thing. And we're now ready to record Linux Voice Podcast Series 4, Episode 1. I'm still Andrew Gregory.
I'm still Ben Everard.
I'm still Graham Morrison.
And I remain Mike Saunders.
And, sticking with tradition, we've got news in this podcast. We've got a halfway reminder, possibly two-thirds of the way through. Finds of the Fortnight, we have Vocalize Your Neurons, which used to be called Speak Your Brains. We also have the Voice of the Masses, and maybe one more thing. I don't know, I never know, we never know. It's all part of the constructive anarchy that is the Linux Voice podcast. If you want something just as constructive but less anarchic, we also do a magazine. Also called Linux Voice. Crazy, eh? That's available in several shops. All good news agents and... Online. All the good ones. All the good ones. Online at our shop, which is shop.linuxvoice.com. And you can subscribe to us. And all subscribers get DRM-free PDFs, which includes all of our back issues. So at the moment, if you buy a subscription now, you get access to 24 issues of Linuxy goodness, which is an utterly fantastic value. Right, what's next?
I just want to say Andrew's looking really good, I think. He's got a really healthy glow about him.
It's Christmas. Well, yeah. It's the post-Christmas,
You do look great.
Thanks, Graham.
That's it, sorry.
You also
the rest of us all look terrible.
I know. Okay, sorry, news.
News. First up, it's quite a sad way to start the new year. It's Ian Murdoch, one of the creators of Debian, the Ian in Debian, has died. The circumstances surrounding his death are still sort of not widely published. And it's sort of, there's two accounts of the story. In the night before he died, he put up a series of Twitter posts claiming that he was a victim of police brutality and sexual assault, and that they followed him to his house to arrest him and so forth. And the official police report, they say that he was trying to break into his neighbour's home and he injured himself by banging his head onto the cage between the front and the back of the police car. We don't have any information as to which of these accounts is correct or if the truth lies elsewhere. And all we can do is offer our sympathies to his friends and family. Yeah, quite young.
Still feels relatively young to me. And also, it's like one of those generational things. I feel like he's one of our generation, also hugely influential in the way that we all use Linux and open source software. He was incredibly instrumental in... Debian just has one of the best... kind of open and democratic communities of any community, but especially in open source. And he was responsible for that, you know. And he's also in the benevolent dictator for life thing. He was happy to genuinely hand it on and let Debian flourish in its community. And, you know, that's a huge part of why we're here doing this and why Linux is so influential now. It's like one of the Beatles dying.
Yeah.
Probably for us, for the generation that grew up with the Beatles.
That point about Ian Murdoch not setting himself up as a benevolent dictator for life. Benevolent dictators, however well-intentioned they are, or do make mistakes. We've seen other distros that have quite a autocratic command systems. Yeah, we all know which one I'm talking about.
Dictator is another part.
just get stuff wrong. And it was immensely big of him to take this really successful project. Actually, no, maybe that was why it became successful, because it could never go off in mad, spiraling, crazy, Linspire-like directions and alienate large users, large numbers of its community. The fact that Debian was set free meant that
you know, it could never be messed about with.
Of course, he went on to do Progeny Linux as well, which is, I don't know if you guys remember that.
I've never tried it. I remember it.
No, I think it was a version of Debian with the Anaconda installer taken over from Red Hat or Fedora at the time. And I think it was his attempt to follow up on the success of Debian with a more sort of user-friendly desktop-centric distro. It didn't last for very long. I know it shut down in 2007, and I hadn't even thought about it in years, but I just got reminded of it the other day after he died, and people were talking about some of the things he'd done.
I never met Ian, unfortunately. Did you ever meet him, Mike?
No, I haven't. No, I never got the chance to meet him, no.
Should we move on to some slightly happier news?
Yeah, I guess there's not much. There's so little information, and also it all sounds so kind of gossipy and scurrilous, and, you know, it's really sad that he's gone.
Okay, our next item in the news this Fortnite is that AMD is moving to more open source software. And this actually isn't that new, but we haven't reported it before. And this is more than just drivers, although they are changing the way their drivers work as well. This involves changing the kernel side of the driver to be open source. So it'll effectively allow you to use a completely open source official driver and get some reasonable general use out of your GPU. There'll be an additional closed source bit that sits next to this. It runs in the user space, which will allow you to get access to more of the sort of features of your GPU. And as well as this, there's a low-level SDK called GPU Open, which will allow sort of games developers and that sort of type of person to get quite high performance out of the GPU. So basically, it's a complete change of the way that their GPU software stack works, and with a significant swing to the open source side. So it's looking like we might finally have some decent open drivers for AMD GPUs.
That's fantastic. Did you say then that the proprietary blob is going to be running in user space?
Yes. So the entire kernel side will be open source.
That's really good. I wonder if that affects performance.
I mean, there has been a sort of split between kernel space and user space before this. That's not fundamentally new. It's just that the kernel side will be open.
It's difficult for AMD. It used to be the ATI Radeons, wasn't it, that AMD bought?
Yes.
And they're the GPUs used in the Xboxes and the latest PlayStation generation. So they're always competing with Nvidia, and both of them are so reluctant to let go of their secret sauce, the stuff that goes into these GPUs that makes them a little bit faster than the other, because, you know, some of them cost £600 or £700, £800.
Yeah, my guess is that this is a move to try and make them the GPU of choice for Steam boxes, because you can get reasonable performance out of an open outside that onboard GPUs. I mean, not for a hardcore gamer, but for a casual gamer.
Yeah.
So you could put in just a straight AMD CPU, including the GPU, which you obviously can do with Intel chips as well. But to create Steam boxes that way at a better price point than sticking in a discrete GPU.
Why would they care then about making it more open source friendly?
Just so it's easier to sit in the software stack.
Right, it'll become more tested, and so all the open parts will become part of the kernel, and everything's properly coexisting.
Yeah, because, well, we've certainly seen Valve work quite closely with Intel on the Steam boxes because Intel's software stack is much more open than Nvidia's and AMD's on the GPU side, at least.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. I wonder if Nvidia could follow suit. Unfortunately, Nvidia's drivers are always so closely related to the Windows driver that a big change in architecture like this probably wouldn't be worth their effort.
Yeah, this is a long-running strategy from AMD, really, because they started opening up their documentation a little while ago so people weren't having to reverse engineer everything for the open drivers and all that sort of thing. So it's not a sudden change in policy. It's a gradual shift across. which NVIDIA hasn't done much of.
In a related news story, did you see that the PlayStation 4 has been hacked to run Linux?
Yes, I did see that.
It's a PlayStation 4 with an ancient version of its firmware and an exploit that runs through, I think, through the WebKit browser or something like that. And they just got GPU acceleration working just a few days ago. I mean,
oh, they've got GPU acceleration working.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Ah, I think it's quite interesting that the PlayStation 4 runs FreeBSD, so they've hacked a FreeBSD machine yeah. to run Linux.
Yeah. I know, but I mean, I haven't looked too deeply into it, but looking at the some of the posts about the hardware that was inside that box, it really looks like an impossible task to get it to be a Steam Box equivalent, for example. It's just far too kind of proprietary and esoteric to operate as a normal PC and still perform as well as, you know, a PC that you may just spend 150 quid on.
So it's more for like playing Frozen Bubble and XBuild on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it seems to me that just like the pure technical challenge of doing something like this is because Sony will come down hard on any exploits it finds anyway, so it's going to be impractical.
Yeah.
What was the machine that used to run, was it Yellow Dog Linux? Was that the PS2?
It was the PS3.
PS3, right.
Yeah. So, in fact, Sony's had a long history of helping developers. There was a PlayStation 2 developer kit that you could buy into. And on the PlayStation, the early fat PlayStation 3s, there was an other OS option by default in the normal menus of the games console. And that allowed you to put, Yellow Dog Linux in and install Linux on a different partition. It didn't have access to all of the cell architectures or the accelerated GPUs. You just had to use the frame buffer. But yeah, it was a brilliant move by Sony. And then they removed it. They effectively removed the feature.
Yes.
Did they get into trouble for that? Because they basically took away a feature that was installed. I never quite worked that out. You can't give somebody something, then sell it to them, and then remove a feature afterwards retroactively.
There was. I can't remember now whether there was a class action suit, a lawsuit against them for it. But I think Sony effectively said, well, if you want Linux, don't upgrade the firmware. But that would mean that more modern games wouldn't have worked. But it did create quite a problem, but obviously not enough of a problem to warrant Sony going back on its decision. I had Linux installed on my PS3 at the time. So, it was a great move, and it's really sad that it was... I don't think it was even because that was the way that people exploited the PlayStation 3. It wasn't that. Maybe it just... I don't know. Yeah, disappointing.
Didn't the PS3 have a really weird chip architecture?
Yeah, it did. It had like that PowerPC-based cell, they called it. So it was like 7 or 8 cores of power of a basically an old Pi PC core.
And you could use Yellow Dog to link them all up together and create a really budget supercomputer.
Yeah, and I think lots of people, I mean, there were lots of places where the PS3 was used, like in huge racks, for processor intensive tasks. And, you know, the SETI at home client and stuff like that ran on it by default, which was quite cool at the time. But yeah, consoles now are very much consoles. You know, left, right, up and down, press X.
Up, down, left, right, ABC, start.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the hardware inside them is much more standard than it was.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this would be much easier to get everything running, in principle, at least.
Yeah. It's quite an interesting history, really, because if you look at how influential XBMC or Kodi is now, I mean, you know, like on the Amazon Fire or something, that's purely the result of the original Xbox being x86 architecture, a PC in a box that people subverted and ran created a media player for. You know, now a brilliant media player that's used all over the place. And you can see how kind of innovation blossoms from open architecture and people being able to access things, and yet things get more restrictive.
Yeah, because it's one of those things that XBMC and obviously Kodi has become, you know, hugely successful, but none of that benefits the Xbox in any way anymore.
No. No. I mean, maybe this is a real strength of the Steam Box. Maybe we should, you know, it's something that they're not making much of an issue of, but something that maybe we could get behind if we really cared that much about gamers. Just by saying that, I'd probably get in trouble.
I think the Steam Box is a really interesting development in the console space, but I really don't know how it's going to go. And I think it's one of those things that I don't think anyone really knows yet. It's sort of an experiment, and I think it will significantly change things, and a lot of it will depend on how Microsoft and Sony react to it if it does gain traction.
Well, I mean, I was reading the Valve revenue figures just the other day, and they're huge, you know, and basically Valve has got like 24% of every dollar that goes through Steam. It's incredible. And there are lots of games making, you know, tens of millions of dollars, $100 million through the platform. It's a massive thing that they've moved it to Linux. And with Valve behind, I'm sure Valve will stick with Linux as their platform of choice for their own games going forward and keep pushing it. And it may be irrelevant, like it's kind of irrelevant now that Linux is in the Android kernel, that in 5 years' time, yeah, that's the Steam box, it runs, you know, Steam as a platform, and it just happens to be Linux again. But hopefully Linux and the desktop will always be accessible in the way that Linux was co-installable on the PS3.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other way it could go. As it becomes successful, Valve could decide to start closing it down.
Yeah.
That's probably quite enough games and graphics news for one podcast. Should we move on to some networking? IPv6 marked its 20-year birthday recently by reaching the dizzying heights of 10% adoption. Yeah. Which is actually more impressive than it sounds, because obviously 20 years is a long time, but almost all of that growth has come in the last sort of 3 years. Yeah. And it's grew about 60% over the last year. So it's certainly accelerating its adoption, and it could well become a seriously well-used network protocol in the next sort of 3 or 4 years.
Well, it has to become a seriously used network protocol, doesn't it? We don't have any other choice.
Yeah, we do. We can keep sticking NATs in every possible place and just sharing IPv4 addresses. I mean, there's no reason that won't work, because hardly anyone wants a public readable IP address. If you ask the people, you know, the average network user, do you want your own IP address? They'll go, what's an IP address? And if you explained it, they'll go, okay, why do I want one? And the answer is most people probably don't.
But NATs are horrible. They, you know, they're horribly complicated. And imagine what it's going to be like in a few years' time. You know, it's bad enough as it is with, you know, 10 devices or 20 devices behind a router and you're trying to play a game with someone or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, IPv6 should be the future. It needs to be. But it's a future that, it's one of those things that it costs companies to put in, their customers don't care about. Of course, it's going to take a long time to go in.
Yeah.
But a lot of the
security.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if it's working well. It doesn't matter. It's invisible.
Yeah,
yeah. Because I mean, how many people complain that my mobile internet connection doesn't give me a public IP address or my own public IP address?
Good point.
Now, you'll start to complain when you know you can't get onto the internet, but your friends on another network can.
That won't happen because IPv4 will live forever. It's never going to die. It can't. There's too many IPv4 devices that just aren't going to be changed.
But surely once IPv4 is massively overcrowded, it'll be easier to get onto the internet if you're using IPv6.
Probably not, because you'll just share IP addresses between a larger number of people. And there's no, for general internet usage, there's not a significant problem to that.
Oh, in that case, damn with IPv6. What's the point?
I mean, as Graham says, the more NATs you have to throw in, that's going to affect performance. But
so it will affect performance.
Well, maybe, maybe not.
Okay.
It will, but it does already.
If you're a gamer, it does already affect performance. The further away from a direct IP address you get, the add milliseconds of latency.
Yeah, but only gamers would notice the difference, really. Your Netflix stream will run just as well. I mean, it does open up some really cool possibilities, IPv6, but they're not possibilities that your average user cares about. You know, I would quite like to have a static IP address on my home connection.
Yeah.
No one else anywhere near, living anywhere near me, probably cares.
No.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd quite like to have several static IP addresses, but again, I'm the only one that cares.
I used to pay extra to have a static IP address with my old provider, Be Unlimited, but they got bought by Sky and they removed that facility. And in the old days of Demon, Sky is... Demon Internet on my Amiga, I had a static IP address.
Were you contacted by Sky for their trial of IPv6?
No. I'm not with Sky.
They're running a private... Ah, sorry.
Yeah, no, I cancelled it as soon as Sky got involved. Sorry.
Yeah, it seems that none of the major UK providers are doing IPv6 yet.
And
a few smaller ones.
And that's
like
what it'll take.
Andrews and Arnold are.
Yeah, because they've got the infrastructure. And in fact, all the routers that they ship out are capable of it.
Yeah. Let's stay on networking for a moment and but move across to encryption over networking. And the Dutch government has surprised world governments and citizens around the world by actually saying something sensible about encryption.
Oh, hang on. No, Dutch people in saying something sensible, shock. That's not a surprise at all.
But governments in saying something sensible, shock, is a surprise.
The political classes.
Yes. Dutch sensibleness, the fact that Dutch sensibleness has percolated its way up to the government.
But for how long? Is that because everyone's still on Christmas holiday and the intern has posted a message?
Could be. This is a report by the Ministry of Security and Justice, which was asked by Parliament to produce a report on backdooring encryption, basically, in the wake of the Paris attacks and whether or not, you know, breaking encryption would save everyone and such like. And I'm just going to quote from the report now. It says, by introducing technical input into the encryption product that would give the authorities access would also make encryption services vulnerable to criminals, terrorists and foreign intelligence. This could have undesirable consequences for the security of information communicated and stored and the integrity of ICT systems, which are of increasing importance for the functioning of society. Which I think is completely correct.
Yeah, yes. Fine.
It's so correct, it should be mathematically provable. That's what... We need society needs some kind of calculus for sensible decisions, you know, that you can prove something.
That sounds like a Jonathan Swift or a Jeremy Bentham type idea.
I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Listeners, let us know.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Brilliant. Thanks, thanks, Ben. I'm just trying to work out whether Mike's still with us or not.
Oh, I am. I've got my fines all lined up here, ready to go.
Yeah, sorry, Mike's having some connection problems, and so he's had to turn off video, and it's been replaced by what looks like a picture of a wing of an aeroplane.
Yeah, that's something from about 8 years ago. I can't remember where I was flying to. I think Barcelona, to a good old Novell event back in the day.
Wow, before the podcast.
Well, maybe when we were doing an old podcast, but Anyway.
Okay.
Anyway.
So it's fine to the fortnight. I did ask the IRC channel. Always grateful to them because we give them no notice and they always respond with a few fines. There's a couple there. One from Devilman sounds particularly interesting. My find is Wi-Fi Privacy Police, which is an Android app available on the F-Droid App Store. It prevents leaking of SSIDs of other networks you may have used in the past. Simple but useful privacy tool.
I didn't realise you could leak SSIDs that you may have used in the past.
No, you're right. No, I'd never. I kind of assume everything goes because I'm just, you know, a pessimist. James Olympus agrees that does look like a great find. He says, I'll offer Sterling's approximation as an interesting find. I've really no idea what he's talking about, but I'll put the link. There's been a discussion on IRC over the last couple of days about old school calculators, I think, from the 80s and 90s. And they've been doing all kinds of sums on those calculators and trying to benchmark their performance. I've only kind of dipped in, so they're still actually talking about those. McPhail says, my find has been using slash U mode plus R on IRC, stops the majority of drive-by private messages. That's a useful useful tip. I didn't know that. I don't actually get that many private messages. He's also found that using Bcache, using an SSD as cache for HDD, handles power cuts quite gracefully, having had some problems with the electricity during this recent storms. That's another great find. Those are the brief ones from our RSC channel. Do you want to go ahead with one of yours then, Mike?
I will. Actually, I've had two of them sent to me this episode. The first one is from Scott Ramsey, who says, run sudo apt-get install xflip and then sleep300 meltdown-wait20 on someone unsuspecting's computer while they are away. 5 minutes later, their screen will melt and stay blank for 20 seconds. Try this on someone before the podcast. Bonus points if you can have it happen to someone during the podcast. That sounds rather cool, Scott. Unfortunately, we're all scattered around Europe, so I don't have root on Ben's or Andrew's or Graham's computer in order to do that.
I'm not in Europe.
Andrew's not in Europe. He's in North England.
The People's Republic of Yorkshire.
I'm in Sealand.
Scott also sent me a link to helloworldquiz.com, which is really cool. It's a game where you guess a programming language based on the source code for Hello World. So some of them are quite obvious, but some of them really make you think about obscure functional languages or types of assembly. And then the final one is from Remy Van Elst, who says, I found a nice tool which I use daily named NCDU. It's a simple interactive disk usage analyzer. It shows you where the big files and folders are, including the amount of files, which is handy when your inodes are full. I use it daily in my sysadmin day job, both for troubleshooting a full server when MySQL stops when the disk is full, and for maintenance. Thanks, Remy. I have heard of this tool before because it's an Ncursors one, so you can just run it when you're SSH'd into a machine, but it looks pretty cool.
Those are my finds. Like excellent finds, yeah. Well done.
Thanks, listeners, for sending them to me.
Does anyone else want to have a go?
I've got a quick discovery, I suppose.
Go for it.
So this is my phone, which I dropped. Yeah. And because it was before Christmas, it was there was no soft water to cushion it.
Yeah.
So it broke. But then I used my elite skills.
Wow.
And I fixed it. Look, check it out. Well, I almost dropped it again there. Look, it's shiny and unbroken.
That's awesome.
Ooh.
Yeah, I was really pleased with myself. It's only tenuously Linuxy because it's a Nexus 5 and therefore it runs Android. But I took it to bits and put it back together again with like new bits. But the discovery really was just the simple joy in taking stuff to bits and putting it back together again. Yeah. I used to love doing that when I was a kid. I just used to unscrew things and take them to bits and then put them back together again.
Like, what a wonderful feeling it is.
How many screws have you got left over?
I lost one on the carpet. So only one.
Ah, not bad.
It is brilliant. Yeah,
And the phone works.
It's that bit where it's all back together and you press the power button for the first time. It's like, will it work?
That well done. That is brilliant. I mean, I think it was one of my finds, like, whenever I last dropped my Nexus 5. And I had a two or three emails from people who wanted a little bit of advice on doing the same thing. And two of them, it worked. For one person, it didn't work, so... The Nexus 5 was quite good for being so repairable.
Yeah. Did you have to use any like weird shaped screwdrivers or anything? Or was it
the kit came. It was I think it was £30 for a screen and a new battery, and it also came with a thing that looks a bit like a guitar plectrum that you use to pry bits off, and like five or six little tiny wee screwdrivers, and I only used one.
Okay.
I could hold them up so that I'll hold them up to the microphone so that listeners can hear them. They've got a different, like one's got a star shaped head and one's got a, I don't know, hexagon shaped head. Maybe I think it's just the standard phone repair screwdrivers that they use for iPhones and everything, which is why there's different shaped screwdrivers.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I only use the one. No, it's good.
Ah, cool.
Cool.
I feel elite.
In a slightly related find, if anyone had been to my house in the last year or so, really since we started Linux Voice, I've had a load of components lying, loads of bits of circuit board and stuff lying on a table here. And I just haven't had the chance to put them all together. They're actually parts of a hi-hat sound module drum synthesizer thing. And I finally got the chance over Christmas to put it all together. Here it is. It's like three boards all soldered together. It makes an awesome, crunchy hi-hat sound. But
so just a hi-hat or the whole drum
kit? No, it's just a hi-hat. It does an open and a closed hi-hat. It's brilliant. It's I haven't got it plugged in, but I actually finished it. I finished putting it all together last night. And I can't tell you how good it feels. This is like a New Year's resolution thing, really, that I've had those bits lying around when people came and stayed here, and they're awful. They just all took over the whole tabletop. I felt bad for never finishing it. Now I've just finally finished it. I feel really good about it. Only really took a few hours of effort. So, yeah, don't put off today what you can do tomorrow.
No way.
I've got a couple of other finds, as I seem to have launched into my finds thing. Let me open up my phone. I haven't tried these, but they looked interesting. They came up on the internet the last couple of days. Well, one is BTFS, which is actually a BitTorrent file system. And this is basically a way of mounting a torrent file in your home directory as a read-only file system. And when you access the files that the torrent contains, they're downloaded on demand through BitTorrent.
So the whole thing's downloaded on demand, or it gets just the bits within the BitTorrent
that you
need? It
gets just the bits that you need within the BitTorrent.
Ah, that's clever.
Yeah, really good for like mounting ISO images of distributions or something, if people still use things that way. And there's another good find that I thought was pretty cool. This one is called Asprite, A-S-E-P-R-I-T. And it's like an 8-bit sprite editor, because indie games design is all the rage at the moment, although I think development of them has tailed off slightly. But I used to do a lot of pixel art in Deluxe Paint. I even had some of my work published in an Amiga magazine back in the day. It was a huge achievement, and it's a really relaxing, cool thing to do. Just being restricted to just, you know, a matrix of pixels that are large and that you can see on the screen forces you to do, you know, manual anti-aliasing and coloring. And it's not only is it relaxing, it's a good creative thing to do. And so this is an open source graphics editor, kind of in the style of Deluxe Paint in a zoom mode, that enables you to draw pixel art and animate it as well. So if you are into indie games development or online games development, then you can become a brilliant games designer and have some fun. They're my finds.
So does that just leave me?
I think it does.
With my finds? Right, my finds. The first one is TLDR pages. That's TLDR-pages.github.io. And these are kind of like a really stripped down version of man pages. If you just want a few examples of how a command works.
That's it.
Go there.
Yeah.
Don't want to read through the whole man page just to find out the simple usage.
Have you ever met anyone who reads the whole man page? Whenever we mention that we only read the examples, everyone agrees.
That's all you want to see.
I sometimes need to read them if you're trying to find out a particular option.
If there's no good example.
Yeah, basically. I haven't had a cause to need the TLDR pages yet. There's not been a thing for it yet. But they do look pretty cool. I'd looked through sort of some of the commands I use regularly, and they had some quite useful examples for them. So, yeah. My second find is the Node MCU. This is, I think I mentioned it a couple of podcasts ago. It's a microcontroller that's, it's a hacked Wi-Fi chip to open up the microcontroller. And I ordered it a few months ago off AliExpress, and it arrived just before Christmas. So it was my Christmas present to myself. And Yeah, it works exactly how you'd expect, how I expected it to. Basically, it runs an interpreted version of Lua on the chip itself, so you can program it over the serial console. They cost like £3, and you can run, it runs a full Wi-Fi stack. It can run a web server, or it can run as a client on there. It's got, I think it was 6 or 7 digital pins, 1 analog in, and a couple of sort of communication things. And it's got a few PWM outputs. So it's got sort of reasonably connectivity. As long as you don't need anything too complex, it should have what you need. And for £3 to have a Wi-Fi stack and everything is fantastic. I mean, that's cheaper than just a Wi-Fi dongle for your Raspberry Pi Zero.
Yeah.
I mean, it's phenomenal value.
What are you using it for?
At the moment, nothing, but I think I'm going to set up a series of, start with a series of wireless temperature sensors around the house.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So I can sort of, because our heating's got, it's a bit weird at the moment, so we've just got a wood burner put in. So obviously the one room gets to we spend our evenings in 28 degrees. The walls of that room will hold the heat through the next day. It's still 23 degrees when we wake up the next morning after the burner's been off for
Yeah, I know, I remember sleeping in there, yeah.
Yeah, it gets pretty warm. trying to get that all sorted. And it's just perfect for Internet of Things type hacking.
Yeah.
The Node MCU itself has got all the gubbins on for USB connection. The Wi-Fi bit itself you can get separately, which is absolutely tiny. But obviously you'll have to build in your voltage regulators and whatnot into your final products.
Right.
That's been quite a fun discovery this fortnight. And my final one is Cyber Squirrel 1. That's one, the number one, as opposed to the written out, .com. And what this is, if you've ever seen someone talk about cybersecurity on the news and mainstream media, you're bound to have heard them talk about how terrorists are just about to take down all our power stations unless we invest billions in defending them and all this sort of thing, and how we're constantly teaching on the apocalypse. And it's certainly possible to do significant damage by hacking, but it's also very difficult to do, and relatively few organizations have the power to do it. And cybersquirrel1.com is rating humans against squirrels in their ability to take down power networks.
Of course.
And other sort of industrial applications. So the statistics are a little bit out of date at the moment. It's not the latest, but according to their figures, there's been 505 cyber attacks by animals, including squirrels. I think it's specifically squirrels. taking out power grids and other industrial control units, compared to 1 by humans. And that was, of course, the US and Israel. Well, probably the US and Israel taking out their nuclear refinement, the uranium refining capabilities in Iran with Stuxnet. So although cyber terrorism does pose a very real threat, currently squirrels are 500 times more dangerous than terrorists.
Excellent. Actually, I owe you a thank you as well, Ben, because I got my little Bluetooth module, you know, the Bluetooth audio module that you put into your antique radio.
It's the KRC-86B, as I
Excellent.
Recall.
That arrived over Christmas, and I got my early 90s boombox out of the attic, took it apart. Really couldn't be simpler. I just had to find, I just found 5 volts floating around off the board somewhere, attached it to that, and found an audio input on the motherboard, soldered it all together, put it all back together. And it's awesome. I'm using it all the time. It's really cool. The CD player doesn't work, the cassette player doesn't work, but I can send music to it from my phone.
Do you walk down the street with it on your shoulder?
I'm going to. Next, when I go camping, I'm going to take it and just be the coolest kid in the campsite. So, thanks. And they are our finds.
Lovely finds, everyone. As we've been recording now for 40-odd minutes, it's time to record the halfway reminder. Still to come in the final roughly one quarter of the podcast, we've got neurons, or maybe an og box. I don't know. We'll just need to wait and find out. And voice of the masses.
Yeah, we've got two neurons this episode, and fortunately enough, they've both been sent to me by the people who sent me my finds as well. So my cup runneth over. The first one is from good old Remy Van Elst again, who says, I've created a small open source simple tool to monitor the expiration of certificates. Over the past weekend, it got a huge traffic spike because it was on a few Reddit front pages and on an InfoSec forum. I thought you might appreciate it for your listeners. Let's Encrypt is live and everybody is playing with it, which is a good thing. However, their certificates only have a 90-day lifetime, which, if their automation would work everywhere, is also a good thing. But many people will play with it now and forget about it in 3 months, resulting in a non-functional website with an expired certificate. My tool allows you to enter one or more websites, which then it'll monitor and let you know when the certificate is about to expire with a few emails. Very simple, very nice. The URL is certificatemonitor.org. Good work, Remy. Sounds like a useful thing for the free software community. And then the other neuron from Scott Ramsey says, I recently completed year 12. And I must say, I'm not sure how I would have got on without free software. The Windows and Mac PCs provided by the school are the most dodgy things ever. Half the time you can't log in and they are often disconnected from Wi-Fi. There was one time that McAfee antivirus was using 97% of the CPU while I was trying to do schoolwork in Windows. I carried around a USB key with Mint installed so that I could get faster startups to get my work done quicker. The only problem was the Wi-Fi didn't work for a while, so I had to keep an Ethernet cable in my bag and plug it in. I also enjoyed having all of my files automatically synced with my home computer, by which I mean booting off the USB at home as well, thus enjoying the same operating system instance everywhere. Another real gain was the software stack. LibreOffice is better than Word for math equations, and Vim is just awesome when it comes to note-taking. Markdown is the best way to avoid messing around with formatting. And if not for Git, I don't think I would have done anywhere as near frequent backups. It was great being able to close Vim and instantly git commit and push from the shell. Backing up became part of the closing program shutting down routine. I did get asked every now and then when I had a terminal open by people, what on earth was I doing? I also had an extra USB key with Linux on it as a backup option. I must thank whichever one of you it was that introduced me to Markdown in the magazine, and Mike for convincing me to give Vim another try, and all of you for showing me that Linux can be a good OS for day-to-day use. If it wasn't for hearing you all on the podcast, I wouldn't have taken Linux on the desktop so seriously. So thank you all for the great podcast, magazines, and general awesomeness. Thank you, Scott. It sounds like you're managing to show your school what's the right thing to do there, instead of forcing kids to use Windows is just crazy. Anyway, those are the two.
Before we, Mike, just my little pro tip: when you're on a machine that doesn't have Wi-Fi drivers in Linux, or that you can't get them, you can use an Android phone as a Wi-Fi device in Linux, and probably Windows actually as well, by connecting to Wi-Fi on your Android phone, plugging it into the USB port of the machine, and in the Android phone, selecting to share over the network over USB, it will work as a Wi-Fi modem, basically.
That's a really useful tip, actually. Yeah.
It's come in really useful for me quite a few times, because they've often got better aerials than like small Wi-Fi dongles as well. So if you're in an area with poor Wi-Fi connection, you can get a faster connection through your phone into Wi-Fi than you can through a laptop or a dongle sometimes. And also, if you've got a really long USB cable, you can do it. You can get it if you've got a room in your house that doesn't have Wi-Fi connectivity and you're too lazy to sort it out properly.
That's awesome. That can help awesome as well. Then, and cool. And awesome neurons. If anybody else wants their neurons vocalized, email them to me at mike@linuxvoice.com.
So that jollity brings us to Voice of the Masses. Apparently, 2015 was the year of Linux and open source software. What next? So what are we basing that wild assertion that 2015 was the year of Linux and open source software?
Well, it's not our wild assertion. It was it's a wild assertion posted over on ZNet.
Ah, yes.
By a world-renowned journalist with an awful lot of experience who writes about Linux a great deal.
Stephen J. Vaughan Nichols says, in 2015, Microsoft embraced Linux. Apple open-sourced its newest, hottest programming language. That's Swift, isn't it?
Yes.
And the cloud couldn't run without Linux and open-source software. So why can't people accept that Linux and open-source have won the software wars? Yes, let's give a plug to an awesome Swift programming resource, and that is Well, just Google Paul Hudson and Swift. Paul used to be the editor of a magazine that we all used to work on. And he also used to appear in this podcast, or in its previous incarnation. And he's a crazily intelligent fella and also a really excellent communicator. So if you want to learn about Swift, then Googling his name with the word Swift is a superb way to start. He's written a book, hasn't he? He's written several books, actually.
And he's just written another one, actually, just this week. Hacking with Swift is his book on Swift, and it's free. You can get it through his website. But he's just done one on Node or something like that. Without Googling for it, I'm not exactly sure. But yes.
Other web searches are available.
Yeah. I actually use DuckDuckGo, but I seem to type exclamation mark G in every single search. Sorry.
Right. So why can't people accept that Linux and open source have won the software wars? Is this correct? What does it mean? Can we all take it easy now the fight is over? Should RMS start a well-earned retirement? Alternatively, is there some other digital fight that we should pick up, such as the right to privacy, ensuring children get a good computing education, or narrowing the digital divide? Let us know what you think. And you have in your numbers. Only 14, but that's our fault, because we only put this up on Tinternet yesterday. So, let's kick off with Phil Fain, who says, once governments realise that mandating backdoors and weak encryption in mainstream commercial apps does nothing to stop people using free software implementing their own security, there are likely to be moves to outlaw free software. Not in Holland. That was quite a long sentence. That was all one sentence. And I think it was that encryption, any sort of government monkeying with encryption will fail as long as there is free software.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be free software. It just has to be software that the government can't meddle with. So any software written, say, in Holland, we could use in the UK, unless Cameron's digital firewall thing blocked it at the Channel Tunnel. So I don't think you necessarily need free software to do that.
Maybe when we leave the EU, we'll have a digital dogger bank to keep us safe.
Oh, this could be like back in the day when we installed a distro and it didn't have MP3 stuff installed by default. You had to go and get that because no one was quite sure if it was legal or not.
Yes.
Maybe when you install, there'll be like a British version of Red Hat or whatever that you can install, and then you sneakily type in a little command that no one could possibly know.
Britux.
Download. Yes.
Register it now. Polyamorous Penguin says, open source may have won, but what we really want is free software. The next challenge is to educate the masses on the difference. Otherwise, corporations will still run amok with our freedoms. Yes, it was a bit of a facetious question. Of course, we can't go and sit down and chill out because there are always people that just want to take the mic. Mike, you just pulsed your avatar.
Really?
Yeah, it's doing it again.
Wow. I don't know. I've got nothing to say.
Nothing to say. Move along. Sorry, you can't tell. Normally I'd look at your... Normally we'd look at your blank face and we'd know that you had nothing to say.
Or we see that he's gone off to get his lasagna or whatever it is, but now we just don't know.
I am getting hungry. It's 1 hour ahead here.
Okay, sorry, back to Holland, the Netherlands, sorry. Kevin O'Brien says, the big issue I see is whether free software can persist in the face of government opposition to encryption and privacy. I hope it can, but it is not guaranteed. I mean, it sounds like if Cameron gets his way, then there may become maybe government legal opposition to free software.
Even Cameron's not stupid enough to actually try and outlaw free software. They may, yeah.
But you could do try it by implication, you could.
You could ban certain bits of free software. They could insist you have to use a patched version of OpenSSL or whatever. But actually, outright banning free software is not going to happen.
I mean, we've been through times like this before. I mean, in thinking of the question, I do think there is some danger in. I think maybe someone made the comment on the Linux Voice comments there that open source has won and Linux has won to an extent because it's a pragmatic solution. That everybody can understand. It's actually better at doing things in this open source collaborative way than it is in doing it in a closed small group way. You know, 12 people working on a single project isn't as good as 2,000 people working on a project. And that I do think that is an interesting challenge for those of us who care about free software and Linux over the next 10 years that we've never really found ourselves in the position to think about, because it has got to this kind of critical mass where most projects are now open source. Linux is accepted, but only in a kind of a twisted, mutated form. Where does that leave us? Where does that leave any kind of movement? I really don't have an easy answer for it. I don't think free software alone is enough. Encryption could be and privacy could be, but then there has to be a pragmatic reason why free software is better. What is it that you get out of it? And yes, your privacy could be one of those things.
On the subject of pragmatism, Orange Dolphin says, it definitely seems like open source is winning due to it being the pragmatically better option. Let's call this transition zero. The process of corporations and other big client entities recognizing that even though it counters their intuition, sharing means that everyone ends up better off. Now it's time for transition one, acknowledging that A, sharing is worth protecting, and B, everyone's knowledge is built on other people's knowledge, and keeping your secret is a theft from your fellow humans. So I hope that RMS won't be planning a retirement for a long time yet.
Great comment.
Yeah, I like that way of thinking.
I mean, you say that people don't, open source isn't like a reason that people get something, but I think for the average consumer, the huge advantage of open source is that stuff doesn't get EOL, doesn't get end of life. So you don't have this situation where something you bought is no longer updated and left to rot, basically, because it's wildly vulnerable or doesn't work with newer stuff. I think that's something that we should really be pushing as the reason to get open source software, because that's something that's tangible for your average consumer. Oh, that XP laptop that you can't use anymore because it's so riddled with viruses and
but these are
not supported anymore.
These are the same consumers who have now become kind of desensitized to spending hundreds of pounds on a mobile phone every 2 years. And it's got worse.
I'm not sure that many people are desensitized to it. And I think over the past, I don't know, probably 5 years, there's been a significant improvement in the quality of the phone you've been able to get every 2 years. I think that's now tailed off. I think we're starting to reach a plateau and people are starting to look at it and saying, okay, the new phone's now, actually, I can't do anything that I couldn't do on this two-year-old phone. Why can't I get updates? Why is it?
Yeah, no, that's true. Problem? Yeah. I still don't see any evidence that open source has helped in terms of end of life in anything. I mean, it helps perhaps if you're using something like LibreOffice instead of MS Office. But in terms of devices, unless you're technical, the open source aspects of most hardware is almost impossible to get to.
If that's true in its current incarnation, you're probably right. But if you're talking about something like getting a laptop with that ran, you know, a standard distro, then that's going to continue to run forever.
And they're still rarer than ever.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we are all doomed.
On the subject of doom, Ben says, not meaning to be politically incorrect, what open source lacks is a fundamentalist, extremist, jihadi movement. No offence meant to the agnostic, heathen, proprietary software using Nancy's out there. A victory that can't be seen is one that can't be seen to matter. Dominance in the cloud, the browser, the server space is an invisible dominance. Being confident of a victory leads to complacency. A complacent minority risks extinction. A vocal and belligerent minority, on the other hand, is noticed. Lots of logical threads there to spin together.
What's slightly concerning is that I feel like I don't know whether this is me or my age or whatever, but we're part of some kind of movement. It's had an important role to play in the way that technology is being used now. That doesn't mean that how we feel or why we've been engaged in Linux and open source is going to translate to whatever the next important thing to tackle is. Not all of us are going to care so much about security or privacy or encryption or free software or whether something's open source. And that almost needs a new generation. I'm not talking about age, but of technically literate people to understand the issues and take them up. They don't have to inherit those issues from the Linux and free software community. Otherwise, it's just going to be a diminishing pool of people who can do anything.
So what are the next battlefronts going to be then?
In privacy is obviously a huge one, and it's going to be ongoing. And I think we're at the point in privacy that we were in the point in free software probably 10 years ago, where it was something that a small number of people cared about, but it was it was hard to convey to the average person the importance, and it wasn't widely accepted in industry. And we're starting to get to the point, okay, it is starting to be a little bit accepted now in industry. Some people are starting to actually sort of push it as a feature to sort of invest in it commercially. But it's still at sort of nascent stages, and it could easily be derailed. It wouldn't take a lot to push the fight for privacy back a long way. Yeah, and it wouldn't take that much to push it that far forward either. It's sort of almost in the balance at the moment, and the next few years I think are going to be really critical in that area.
But I don't really want to go on too much, I suppose, but the reason why open source is one is because you could show people why it's better to do this, or the reason why that LibreOffice has won or OpenOffice has started to win is that, you know, you can say to people, when you're in conversation, you're sick of having to upgrade MS Windows all the time, or your file's not being compatible with people with different versions. Just use this. Just use Linux. It's how much harder to say you feel like your privacy is being infringed upon, or, you know, there's nothing to really, but most people are really going to care about, I think. That's what worries me. We need to say, this is the problem, you're feeling the problem, and this is the solution. It's becoming much more political, I suppose.
Identifying the problem.
Yeah.
Right then, so I think that's enough for today, don't you? Yeah. You know, I don't think we've reached any conclusion, but as the question is about what's going to happen this year, we've got a whole year to find out and to shape the future for ourselves.
I do think that great comment was about the fact that we can show that it's more innovation comes through openness and all that stuff. I think that's the way to go, to try and finish on a positive note. I think that's a way of showing that, no, this is where it works. This is where you're going to get advantages. And hopefully Holland becomes, you know, much more competitive and much more effective than countries that have a much more closed-minded attitude. And that's the proof.
Great. Well, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Happy New Year to you all.
Oh. There's one more thing.
Hey, Ben, you're brilliant.
This is actually a follow-up one more thing to the last podcast. I'll just give you the answers quickly. For the.
I can barely remember that. Why is it that I find it so difficult to remember?
So, question one was, gave you three commands and asked which one of them would produce an animal on the screen. Apt moo will do a picture of a cow. Aptitude-vvvvv moo will give you a picture of an elephant eating a snake. And if you want to know why, start with apt moo, aptitude space moo, and increase the number of V's in between, and you'll get a little story. Synaptic HJK.
Of course. I love the way you say it. Like, yeah, of course you do. Of course you just get a little story.
Of course. What else would you get? And Synaptic HJK Moo was wildly made up by myself, and it will just throw you a weird error about not knowing what on earth you're talking about. About the mascots, Python does come from Monty Python. Guido Van Rossum is a fan. The Tux is the mascot and not the logo, because he lost a vote. And the actual logo, this is back in 2.6 days, is sort of like a light bulb with Linux power that you'd never see anywhere anymore. It's the false one was that the GNOME logo, it is not the left four-toed left foot because of a Norse mythology. I have no idea why it's a four-toed left foot, but gnomes don't come from Norse mythology. So that was the tricky one there. The kernel release, which has the word penguin in the most times, is the 2.6 release, or specifically 2.6.37.6. I don't know what happened in 2.6.37.7 to reduce the number of penguins. And that comes from the always interesting kernel swear count. The fairy penguin and the chinstrap penguin are both real types of penguin. The greybeard is not. And the Latin name for the gnu or wildebeest means beard or hairy. Oh, so that is why it is relevant to Richard Stallman. Mm. And those are the answers to our pub quiz from last issue.
Excellent. Thanks very much for doing that, Ben. That was good fun. Okay.
Right, see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah,
see you in 2 weeks.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Happy New Year.